copyright Forum of Christian Leaders. The contents contained on this website are solely for your own individual, non-commercial, and informational use. Any other use is strictly prohibited without our express prior written consent. See the full copyright disclosure at focalonline.org.
Welcome aboard. My name's Grenville, and I'm from a very, very southern part of Europe called Australia. just kind of go to Italy and fly for about 24 hours from there, and you'll see it. Yeah, it's on the left. Yeah. And all jokes aside, I do feel very at home in Europe because, you know, Australia is a European settlement, if you want to call it that, primarily, with respect, of course, to our original people and to more recent immigrants, many of whom have come from Europe anyway. What I'd like to achieve, I'll tell you briefly about my background. My current main focus is I'm making a film series, an apologetics documentary series called Big Questions. This is a commercial, bigquestions.com. And my background is, I guess, well, two things. First of all, in film production. So I studied filmmaking and marketing and that kind of thing. And I worked, can we still be friends? I worked for a number of years in advertising. I feel like repenting of that. No, not really. And also in youth ministry, and I became interested in chaplaincy ministry, and so I did more study in theology, and I've worked in academia for about the last 10 years at Wesley Institute. So that's, I guess, love of theology and love of film with a little bit of marketing thrown in. So that's where I'm coming from. Anyone else in the room from a marketing kind of background? No? I can tell you anything then. I can just make things up on the spot. but I won't. I think it does, actually. Yeah, and I think marketing theory has got a lot to tell us about evangelism. So, yeah, and in a sense, that's the main idea of today. That's the main idea of what I'd like us to talk about today. Please feel free to jump in at any time with a question or whatever you'd like to do as we roll. And so a few years back, I pitched an idea to some backers, and I said, look, let's make a film series for secular people. The new atheism was doing its thing in my country, as it probably is in yours. And a lot of people, even though I'd regard the new atheist as an extreme on one side, a lot of people in the middle were kind of influenced towards them. And it had, I think, quite an effect on the middle sensible side of the market, what we'd call the swinging voters. If you think in electoral terms, you've got, you know, conservatives and progressives on either side, and then you've got the middle. And I think they were having an impact. And so we were going to put significant money into it, and so we wanted to get it right and know that we were hitting the target. And so we tried to do a bit of market research, which I kind of just think of as organized listening to people. One thing that fascinates me both as a pastor and also in my other background is trying to understand what's going on in people's heads. Why do you think like that? What's the process that leads you to that conclusion? And I guess... that's what we really tried to do. And just as a starter, I wanted to remind you of the book of Acts. I think Paul does a very similar thing. And much as I'd love to talk about this chapter all afternoon, I'll just briefly make some comments about it. While Paul, Acts 17, was waiting for them in Athens, he was greatly distressed to see that the city was full of idols. So there's Paul... on a commercial break between other ventures, and he's just sitting in Athens, wanders around looking at the idols. Now, if you know a little bit about Athenian culture, you know those idols were completely pagan, exalting violence and erotica and all that kind of jazz, with very different values to Paul's. You probably also know that Paul's been brought up a Jew with a belief that anybody who needs to worship an idol is not only heathen, but probably dumb, because at that time, and forgive the sexism and racism in this remark, but Plato had said not that long ago, but before this, that words are for men, but images are for the weak-minded and for women. I'm sorry, I don't agree with that, and for children. Okay, so if you're a smart man, words are enough for you, but if you're kind of dumb or emotional, like a woman or a child, he said, then you need images. And so Paul's looking at these things and saying, maybe how many Christians respond, certainly my conservative Christian parents responded to television and comics when I was a kid. You know, oh, comics? Are you kidding me? You know, books are for thinking people. Comics are for dummies. Right? It was that kind of a thing. But despite that, we see him putting quite a bit of effort in there. We see him in the marketplace. We see him reasoning in the marketplace with whoever comes by. And we also see him accessing Jews also in the synagogue in that city. We see him talking to Epicurean and Stoic philosophers and debating the two of them. They're the two major schools of philosophy of the day. And he's done his homework in the way that he speaks with each one of them. Just briefly, a lot of his audience would have been influenced, I think, by Epicureanism. Epicurus being the guy who... Actually, Epicurus is still alive and well. Epicurus is telling you, first of all, you and the gods are made of the accidental coming together of different atoms in the universe. It's like Dr. Lennox was saying in the plenary this morning, even the gods are made by accidental collocations of atoms. Right? That's what Epicurus is saying. And so, there's no life after this one. You know what Epicureans used to write on their tombstones? They'd write, I was not, I was, I am not, I care not. Right? I was not, I was, for a while, I am not, I care not. That was their view. So you've only got a certain number of years to live, so you better pack it full of as much pleasure as you can. I don't know about you, but I think that's the philosophy of a lot of marketing, isn't it? Isn't that the idea behind a whole lot of the advertising industry? I'm not going to bother talking about afterlife because we don't know. So let's pack it full of as much pleasure. And Epicurus wasn't a crazy party animal, to put it in those terms. He was much more a, make the pleasure last across a whole lifetime. But the problem with, many Western philosophers have been Epicureans. You see it in the American Constitution, for example. You have inalienable rights, including what? Life, liberty, and? Pursuit of happiness. That's classic Epicureanism. Your mission is to pursue happiness. And I don't criticize that wording. I think there's a beautiful generosity behind those words, but it's classic Epicureanism. And then you've got the Stoics. Now, what does Paul have in common with the Stoics? They believe that reason and logos is behind the universe. You might not call them recent creationists exactly, but they certainly have the view that there's a mind behind nature and us and the universe. So they're believers in a big logical force, which Paul would want to take further and say, I know that person. And John, in the prologue to his gospel, uses that, doesn't he? And he says, in the beginning was the Logos. And all the Stoics go, yeah. And the Logos was with God. Ooh, I don't know about that part. And the Logos was God. Right. And the Logos became flesh. Are you kidding me? No, that's too much. That's a bridge too far. You know, the Logos became flesh? No, that's blurring all my categories. Okay. So you can see what Paul is trying to do then is start on common ground with these people, basically. And you see him being very aware of the market. And Luke, in writing this, is actually very attuned to all the different little sociological things going on in that city. If you read the chapter carefully, it's a very clever piece of observation that he's doing of the different social classes and the different ways of viewing things. It's almost like he's writing about New York City and you can see the yellow cab going by. You know, it's that well observed of what we know of Athens. And then when Paul finally stands up at the Areopagus, he says, people of Athens, I see in every way that you're very religious. For as I walked around and looked carefully at your objects of worship, I even found an altar with this inscription, to an unknown God. And this God that you don't know, that's what I'm going to tell you about. So you see there that the master apologist using, first of all, trying to understand his audience and what they all currently believe. And then you see him using that as a starting point to build his own case. That makes sense? And I guess, to put it fairly simply, that's what I was really trying to do. Not that I'm on quite as grand a scale as Paul, but I was trying to do that in targeting this film series. So there's a biblical reason for it. Marketing theory, this is kind of marketing 101. If you want to write down the letters STP, you've pretty much summed up the basics of marketing. STP. S is segmentation. T is targeting. This is not in your notes. And P is positioning. Okay, so here's kind of like marketing lecture number one in 2 minutes. S, segmentation. What you do is you look at the marketplace, and let's say that you're a car seller. Let's say that you're Toyota. And you look at your country's car market, and you say, okay, what is it? What are some of the differences in your country's car market? What are the factors that make it, you know, that would describe it? Was that a dumb question? Let me put it another way. If you look at car buyers in your country, how could you describe them? What are some useful ways to classify them into different groups?
Budget, premium.
Right, good. Okay, so budget, maybe middle, and premium. Great. What else?
Families.
Okay, so size of car then, isn't it? If you're a single person, you probably want a small little runabout. If you've, like me, got a few kids, you're looking for a car that doesn't exist and trying to fit them all in. That's how it is. Okay, so that's another useful axis. So we could segment the car. Let's just use those two. All right. First of all, you've got the premium buyers. And you instantly can think of, let's go then, premium buyers with big families, what are they driving? They're driving a Mercedes Viano. It's a big 8-seater bus, Mercedes, safe, prestigious, all that. Okay. Then let's go the cheaper end, the budget end of people with big families. What are they driving? There is no car like that I know of. So the car makers must have gone, no, there's not enough money in that one, not going to bother. Okay. Then let's talk about, if you talk about smaller cars, people, you know, single people, for example, or retired people, smaller car, you've got a whole range of different offerings there in the market. Okay, so what some executive has done is gone, let's segment the market in the most useful way. Let's divide it into different segments. Prestige, big. Prestige, small. Budget, big. Forget about... budget, big. Forget about that. Budget, small. Yes, we'll do that one. Middle, big. Middle, small. Okay, you're getting a picture. Now, we could go much more into all the different small details, but that gives you the basic principle. Segmentation. And what I'm trying to do, as we'll see in a minute, is to segment the God market. Does that make sense? And look at, try to classify people usefully in different ways. And then the next thing is targeting. That's how do we reach these people? How do we come up with a product for them? Right? I'm targeting. So the Volkswagen, some of the Volkswagen buses that are out there, that's targeting, at least in my market, a fairly wealthy, upper middle, big car buyer. And you can think of a Mercedes SLK or one of those, prestige, small. Okay, so that's then targeting that group. Thinking, okay, what do they want? What do they value? What do they want in their car? Do they want coffee cup holders or not? You know, and just trying to think that through. If you're going to build a family van, you better put big drink holders all through the whole thing, right? If you're going to build a prestige car, probably not. So there's just little things like that. And then there's positioning. Now, positioning, that's the P. How do we reach them? How do we communicate with those people and say, we've got a product for you? And that's the positioning. Well, first of all, you build your car dealership in a suburb where they live. But if you're Toyota, you're trying to offer a product for all different classes, you probably build it in the city centre. Okay, the next question in position, that's so you've positioned yourself, your shop, in the right place. There's also positioning your advertising. If you're selling to the elite end of the market, there'd be certain magazines in your country and certain TV shows that they consume. If you're selling to the mass market, you'd probably, as beer does, for example, where are all the beer ads in your country? They're probably at the football, right? Because everybody loves the football. That's the great equalitarian game, and that's the perfect place to advertise the frothy liquid. Okay, so does that make sense? So that's then positioning. So any questions on that before we move on? That makes sense? I'm not speaking Swahili. You getting the point? Okay, cool. All right. So then how does that fit with Christianity? Well, I think it's probably relevant to try to segment the God market. Let's talk about that. How could we segment the market, to put it in those terms, for God in your country? Exactly. Yep. So you might say, In my country, I'd say there's a massive group of people who'd call themselves agnostic. Happy sitting in the middle of the fence going, I'm not sure there is, not sure there isn't, whatever, I'll just be a good person. Okay, it's a huge group. Thank you. Age is another one, isn't it? I was talking to a Polish lady on the plane here who said that when she was young, 96% of people were Christian. She said now it's dropped a lot and she doesn't like that. And so yeah, and certainly you can see across 50, 60 years trends that'll make a teenager or a preteen a different target. And I don't mean that in an aggressive sense, obviously, but a different mindset from an older person. Thank you. Yeah. Yeah, okay, perceived needs. Can you unpack that for me a bit more?
Yeah,
great, thank you. Okay, good. So just for the tape, the comment was, most agnostics don't really even think they've got a worldview, it's just transparent to them, but what they are valuing is good relationship, good achievement at work, good family, da-da-da, etc. So exactly, so how do we tap into, and that is, in a sense, has a religious function in their lives, how do we tap into that? So those are some of the segmenting questions, right? Then you get the targeting question, which is how do we then reach that group? What's the best way that God, through us, might be able to connect with those people? And I'm sure Paul had an awareness of this in his ministry because Luke is so attuned to it, to the different classes and views of people. Luke is telling you all about some of the nuances, just giving you enough to know that he knows the different classes and so on. So if you're in the marketplace in Athens, who's going to come past in the marketplace? Everybody. If you're in the Areopagus, who's going to be there? Highly educated, highly well-to-do, politically influential group. And you better understand their thinking and target them very well. Because if you give a soccer crowd message to a parliamentarian, may not be well received. So that's the basic idea there. And then positioning, Paul's choosing to position himself in the marketplace. He's standing there like a travelling philosopher because a lot of people will go by. It's a good media choice. He can't exactly get on television in those days, but he can stand in the public square. And in a way, a lot of theorists have talked about how television and the internet now are like the marketplace, the electronic marketplace, right? The electronic agora of the contemporary world. Does that make sense? So what he used to do in the marketplace, now we do online. So you can shop. If you want to buy your shoes, well, you go to the marketplace in Athens. But today, you might go and buy them online and hope you got the size right. So that's kind of the mentality. So I'm going to argue that marketing is actually really useful preparation for evangelism, just because it gives you some of those basic principles. Now, some of that, I don't know if you've learned anything yet. Some of that stuff is probably common sense. But I've always found it helpful to kind of analyze common sense and go, why does that make sense? In fact, studying marketing was one of the most intuitive things. I remember going to lectures and going, yeah, well, of course. But I just realized I'd never actually put it in words before and that it was, you know. So, all right, so there's segmentation, targeting, and positioning. Now, all I can offer you today is Australian examples, and I, in a sense, want to apologize for that because the last thing I want to do is come in and suggest, like, my culture is the model for yours, all right? What I do hope you can get out of that, though, is some broad principles that you can then apply and think about your own culture. So we came to trying to segment, target, and position our film series. And to start that off, we did some broad interviewing of different people in Sydney, and we realized intuitively that our market was the people in the middle. It wasn't the new atheists, because most of them are so extreme the other way that they're very tough to reach. Very, very tough. It wasn't existing Christians, although we need their support to help us distribute this film series. It was the people in the middle. That was obvious, right? That made sense. But then we said, okay, let's talk to some of them and find out what they currently believe. And so we got a Windshift, which is a social research company, a marketing and social research company who work for big advertisers. And we said, look, Can you just do some interviews with 11, was it, Sydney people representing four different religious traditions because thanks to immigration, we've got quite a spread. And can you just don't interview the really keen ones. Interview people who are just kind of, yeah, I think I'm kind of vaguely Anglican. My grandma was, you know, those kind of people. Only one of them attended church or temple at least monthly. Four attended only for high days and holidays. That's twice a year. And six did not attend at all. We just really did a pilot study to see what we could see. Our research objectives were to understand what's filling the spiritual void for those with low or no attendance at worship. Help me to create more and better documentaries and understand how members of different tribes perceive their spiritual needs. I'll talk about tribes in a second. Here's a summary of what we found. There's a crisis in the social aspects of religion. That's no news, is it? We all knew that one already. There's suspicion at any hint of selling or pushing your own views. And there's a diminished need or respect for institutions and pastoral leaders. And by the way, you're welcome to a copy of these slides. I've got a USB if you'd like to, at the end, see me. You can grab a copy. And there's little sense of a spiritual void. People aren't kind of going, oh man, I need Jesus. You know, they're just going through life. Significant personalization of religion and spirituality. Basically, I'll make it up myself. I'll run it my own way. There's little interest in the universe or the truth. People are comfortable with the mystery. And if they want to think really, really big, they might think in terms of nature, the world, but not the universe. They're not lying there going, man, is there a mind behind all this large complexity and or not? And they're just really getting on with life, in a sense. Okay, so we split it into believers, and we found believers and non-believers, and most of the people we targeted for this research were in the middle. We asked them how people came to believe, and this was kind of interesting. For a lot of people, it was religious schooling. I don't know about where you live, but we've got a strong tradition of Christians starting excellent schools, and everybody wants to go there. That's kind of how it works. People said that often led them to observance. You know, they'd go to chapel and they'd bow their heads during prayer, but they were actually agnostic. No one had bothered to do apologetics. My daughter goes to one of those schools, and I see it again and again. I go to chapel sometimes, and up jumps the priest and just fluffy, 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 and the kids all go, ah, that was nice, and the words kind of go whoosh over their heads like so much expensive hairspray, and nobody actually goes, this is true, because if you think about it hard, here's why it's true. You never see that. And my daughter just sits there going, ah, this is such a waste of time. It could be done so much better. She doesn't say it out loud. But it leads to kind of incompleteness and fuzziness. So you come out of that school, you feel like you know about Christianity. You feel like you've had it and you know it, and it was fluff. And so that's kind of one thing. The other one is the religious family. And there was kind of an expectation that, you know, we're Orthodox, so you should be Orthodox too. Well, okay, it's great for the community and it kind of helps as a community building thing. But the big thing they said there was it leads to compartmentalization. So sure, I'll be really Orthodox on a Sunday once every 3 months for my grandma. That's cool. But the rest of my time I'll live as though it's got nothing to do with any of it. And that's one of the things they talked about. And they also felt they were hypocritical, that they would go along and say all this Christian stuff on one day and then ordinary life would just kick in. They said some people, though, had their own religious epiphany. They had some kind of conviction about it and they were born again. And they knew people like that. And it's interesting, we'll talk later about their views of people who have had that. The relationship with God was seen as on a range between personal and philosophical. The personal one was more reflective of kind of like Hillsong and those kind of religions in their thinking. God's in the back seat of my car. Others saw it as more philosophical. You know, well, maybe it's karma and that kind of jazz. But there was a crisis in the social aspect of religion. Now, here's where we talk about the tribes. And look, this probably won't fit your culture. What I hope it will do is give you an example of this kind of thing. And you might want to go home and just think about what are the tribes in your culture. But here's what they are in mine. You've got it in your notes there. You've got the North Shore tribe, ambitious, hardworking, fairly well-to-do, and it's all about moving up, moving up, moving up, getting richer, more, more, bigger house, better car. Then you've got look, and I apologize, these are based on place names in Sydney, which will mean nothing to you, but I'll just try to describe that briefly. You've got the Toowoomba tribe, that's country people who live on farms and out in the sticks. These are conservatives, They see themselves as stable, common sense people connected to the land, and they are very down to earth. Then you've got the Bankstown tribe. That's basically working class people, okay? Blue collar, working class people. Then you've got the what we call Cabramatta or Campbelltown tribe. Lots of immigrants. Now I know in European cities that may be Turkish immigrants, or it may be African, or various Islamic people. So there's that whole Islamic thing too, which we haven't really thought about here. The Newtown tribe, that's kind of your oh-so-cool urban people who love expensive coffee and, you know, that whole group. I know you've got them, right, in Europe. In fact, we've probably got some in this room. God bless them. Not looking at anybody, okay? Where do they live? Well, they live in the central areas of main cities. They like the coolest gigs, art schools, and universities. They like looking weird from a conservative perspective. I'm not sure I agree with that, but that's what the market research has said. Number six, the Byron Bay tribe. They're kind of our New Agers in a way. They're kind of our wealthy hippies, probably older now. So they're like, you know, peace, love, and mung beans, baby, and they drive nice cars, and they kind of enjoy that. Then you've got what we call the Balmain tribe, the educated intelligentsia, who value ideas above material things and intellectualize every element of their lives. Their most prized possession is a painting by the artist of the moment. They frequent film festivals, secretly wish they had more gay, Muslim, and Aboriginal friends, and feel guilty about discussing property values. And deep down, they're a bit uneasy about how much they love rugby. Okay, this is in my country. You may see some relevance to yours. Where do they live? They're smart. They've moved into the parts of the city that used to be really poor, used to be really working class, and they've gone, hang on, this is like 5 minutes from the city centre and it's by the water. Give it time and it'll boom. And it does. And they've bought three houses there, and they're sitting there kind of going, yeah, I'm making so much money out of this. I bet I feel a bit bad about it. Because what about the poor? You know. So distinguishing characteristics, they prefer to be challenged rather than entertained. You know, they go to movies not just to laugh and feel good, but to actually have to think. They seek out authentic experiences. And then there's the Vaucluse tribe. I love this. The round-vowed children of privilege for whom breeding is the greatest virtue. Manners do really make a difference. Money is great if it's old, but crass if it's new. And the school you went to defines the rest of your life. Where do they live? Leafy enclaves in the elite old city suburbs. And you've got them as well, right? That's a very small group, but very, very influential. Now, look, wherever you're coming from, I'm sure it'll be different in many ways. But there may be some broad parallels with where you're coming from. Okay, so to sum it up, the eight tribes, Vaucluse, we said, elite and entitled. North Shore, the ladder climbers. Just so you know, that's where I live. Toowoomba, provincial conservatives, you know, country people, farmers. Oh, you don't need all that fancy degree, son. You know, you just learn from your dad what really works. And that's all fine. Bankstown, the working class strugglers. Cabramatta, the migrant villagers. Newtown, that, you know, the trendy new culture makers, and they're all you know, graphic designers and filmmakers and music people and that kind of stuff. Not all, but that, you know, that's what they value. Byron Bay, that's your moneyed hippies, and then you've got Balmain, your urban intellectuals. So there's a fair summary. Now, so thanks for the question. How did I come up with these eight tribes? This is from a book which I footnoted in your notes there, where someone went through and said, here's really useful ways of segmenting people. And then she sells that research, for example, to car makers. And if you know, we could spend half the afternoon thinking, what kind of car do all these people drive? Well, it's pretty easy. Vaucluse, that's Rolls-Royce, BMW, Audi territory. So is this, only they're the cheaper models. These guys, lots of Toyota Utes and four-wheel drives. These guys, whatever they can basically afford, really. Lots of Hyundai, actually, where we are, et cetera, et cetera. You can go around. And she sells that kind of research, that social research, to marketing companies and says, I'll go and ask these people about cars if you pay me. And for me, she did it with spirituality, religion, Christianity particularly. And this is what they came up with. North Shore, first of all, make money. Right? That's what you... And I think you made that comment... Sorry, I don't know your name.
David.
David, you made that comment before. That's the number one priority. For the country people, okay, in Toowoomba, the country group, it's all about your family. You got your values and you got your property and all that from your family. Keep it all in your family. Cherish your kids. That's a good thing, right? Bankstown, look, just take it all at face value. Whatever works. If religion helps me, good, I'll grab it. Okay? Cabramatta, this is with us. And I guess this would be similar to some of the Muslim groups in many European cities. Our community is built around the mosque or temple or church. And it's all, you know, it's in the air we breathe. It's everything. And if I dropped away from that religious belief, I'd kind of feel like a stranger in my own suburb and so forth. Newtown, religion, spirituality is a creative synthesis. It can be whatever I want it to make it to be. Okay, that sounds familiar, right? Byron Bay, again, these two are very similar, Byron Bay and Newtown. I reach my own view. Balmain, I desperately don't want to judge others, and I'm looking intellectually for a reasonable faith. And I got to tell you, I think those guys are the easiest target for rational apologetics. That group is just really wants to know, really intellectually curious. Vaucluse, what do they think about religion? To be honest, they're very hard to find, and they're very hard to interview. And market research relies on you paying somebody for their time. It's not worth it to these guys. And so it's very tough to get much information at all. And we didn't, let's be honest. So tribal religions, for the North Shore, it's high days and holy days, and religion's lovely for the children, but don't let it get in the way of the pursuit of money. Okay? For Balmain, they're led by their philosophy and principles. These guys are ripe for Christian persuasion. Newtown and Byron Bay, it's your personal belief system. Cabramatta, family, community, and identity is all part of it. And these guys, the country people and the working class, had a lot in common in that goodness and helping and practical Good Samaritan stuff was what switches them on. And then so does a focus on the family. Okay, what do these people think then of believers and non-believers? Their perceptions of believers, they like us because they think we're family people, we're hardworking, honest, caring, and we look out for others. That was our image. We value the institution of marriage, we value fairness and not doing harm, and we value good. We have a foundation of principles to live by. The negative thing about us, we're goody-goodies. We're a bit earnest and boring. Judgmental. That would never apply to evangelicals though, right? We may think there's only one way to live, and we don't really think for ourselves we're followers. We're sheep. Okay? That's how they perceive us. What about non-believers? I found this really interesting. They're more free. They're not restricted by rules or shoulds, but they're academic and scientific. It's interesting. I think the new atheists have played on that, right? That people think that the atheists are the real intellectuals and the Christians are kind of dumb. Followers. Don't really think for ourselves. You see the problem there. So let's just pick on that for a minute. What are we going to do about that one? How are we going to deal with that problem? What's the best way to respond to a problem, perceptual problem like that?
Can we go back for a second?
Sure.
Because I would like to memorize more of those expressions. And since I'm Hungarian, I don't understand all of them. What is goody-goody?
What's a goody-goody? I'm a goody-goody. Like I'm the good kid in the class, and the teacher really likes me, and not you. it's kind of that.
That's what I thought. Okay, thanks.
No problem. No, stop me any time for that kind of question. That's fine. So how do we deal with the Christians are dumb, atheists are smart perception? It's easy. Wheel out John Lennox, okay? In all seriousness, he was the first person we wanted to interview for this series. When I read that, I kind of knew it anyway. But when this came up in the research, I thought, we've got to show in our film series really smart Christians. We've got to wheel out our top professors. And the first thing I want to say is, we're not all sheep. There's some very, very smart people of faith. Because the new atheists so often make that attack, don't they, on faith? That faith is just believing something you know is not true. It doesn't work if you've got half a brain. And I want to turn that around and wheel out some of our great thinkers in various areas and say, well, look at this. Because in a way, that shows that that's wrong, right? Yeah.
Nailed to a cross.
Yeah.
As the
Yeah, great, great, great comment. Thank you for, so just for the tape, summarizing an excellent comment. In Corinth, Paul didn't try to aspire to showing the intellectual side of faith. He just simply preached the cross, some naked dead Jew on a piece of wood. I mean, what a shocking and bizarre way to start a religion to their minds. And he admits that, you know, the foolishness God uses to show how dumb wise people are and all that, and how weak the supposedly strong people are. And yeah, absolutely agree with that. It's interesting too, because that happens very soon after he's been in Athens, that he goes there and decides to know nothing except Christ and him crucified. And in some ways, I'm not saying this is the whole answer, but in some ways that's a segmentation question. Because in Athens, that's the intellectual elite city. Corinth, generally, is a much more Bankstown, working class kind of city. It's potters, and it's a much more blue-collar city. So in some ways, Paul is matching his message to his audience. And to the ordinary, down-to-earth Corinthian, he's saying, I'm not going to get too flash on you here. I'm not preaching great wisdom. I'm just showing you what works. And this God can relate to you in your weakness. To the Athenians, though, he uses a completely different tactic, knowing his audience, and shows Christ, or begins to introduce Christ in their own terms. So, yeah, thanks for a great comment. If the atheists, non-believers, are the academic, scientific, logical ones, we've got to decide, do we want to own that space? Do we want to have that perception? I think, yes, we do. I don't want Christianity to be perceived as stupid. And so we've got to respond, I think, in that way. But look at their perceptions of non-believers, unrooted, right? No roots. Chameleons, able to change their colours depending on... So no real solid values. Cynical, hard and angry. Interesting. They like Christian virtues. They like that Christians are normally good people and nice people. They like that. They see non-believers, this is their view, not this is not me saying it, as cynical, hard and angry. Not from a good family, maybe. Running with a bad crowd. And having less meaning or purpose. There's a sense of that unbelievers are missing out on something. And this is from people in the middle. This is not from believers. This is the view of people in the middle of the God market. Okay? How can we turn that to advantage? How can we build on that?
So were they putting themselves in these categories?
That's an interesting question. Yeah, I think they probably saw these people as a bit to the left of them. You know, it's not my problem. I'm fine. I'm a good person. But unbelievers, I'm in the middle. I'm open. Yeah, I'm so open. But real unbelievers, they're worse than me. I think that's probably... I don't know that, but that's what I'm assuming. And they don't care. And interesting, they don't celebrate. Celebration probably wouldn't have been the word I'd use of Christianity. We're often seen as a bit joyless. But I guess we've got something to celebrate, haven't we? You know, whether we do that enough or not. And they're on their own. There's a sense of them being kind of lonely and disconnected. So in a sense, if we were smart, we'd build on that existing perception that we do have a big reason to celebrate. We do have roots and we belong. And I think we'd emphasize that in the way that we present our messages. But their perceptions of religion, what did they like about it? They loved the ceremonies and the architecture. They loved, especially the North Shore people, they loved having a church, a nice old stone church nearby because property values went up. They liked having lots of Christians as neighbours because you weren't going to get mugged, they thought. They don't know my... No, I'm kidding. They liked the hymns and the family and the community and the guiding principles, but they hated the fact that they thought religion leads to conflict and division. The religious part of religion is a no-no to me, said one person. Too many hypocrisies. They like the social, do good to the poor side, but not the religious side. They want to convert me, they're judging me, and they're flawed, but they're acting holier than thou. You know, it's back to the goody-goody thing. You know, like, I'm a bit better than you because I've got God and you don't. It's that thing. And they're out of touch with modern life. That was interesting. So we're dumb, and we're followers, and we're back in the 1950s. And so, in summary, belief has separated itself from religious practice, out of touch with modern life, doesn't live up to its principles, and the kind of people who practice religion seem outside the mainstream, a bit weird. Where's the spiritual void? There isn't one. Someone said, I don't want a black and white world. I don't believe in a black and white world. Is life a journey? Yes. But and experiences push you forward. The journey is from birth to death, though. I'm not even sure that there's an afterlife, they say. And your choices and actions may lead to different paths or options. So what's your purpose in life? Okay, religion's normally about purpose. What's your purpose? First of all, make money. Then honour my family. There's Western materialism right there in that answer. Your first thing you got to do, and the best way to provide for your family, money. It's just right there in your face. What's your role or identity focus? Well, be a good person and provide for my family. How do we deal with that be a good person thing? This comes up so much in the research. I'm a good person. The meaning in life is to be a good person. How can we deal with that one in terms of Christian mission? What's the good thing about it? What's the good thing about someone wanting to be a good person? How is that an opening for us?
If they're using the category of good, then they'll be in principle categories of sin and guilt.
Bingo, thank you. I think that's the strong point. They've still got a sense of good. So at that point, there's probably some foundations for building the moral argument. Okay, the idea that there is such a thing as solid right and wrong, and then the old moral argument that just basically says, well, you can't get those from a selfish gene, you can't get those just from society, it's not enough. The only solid place to build morality, love of neighbour, is on theism. And I think they kind of get that, as we'll see later on. The paradox is that many secular people look at us and go, we like immorality, but we don't like the downside of it, which is judgmentalism. You said it better than that, sorry. But yeah. So in a sense, I think that's, be a good person is a big one. But what's the potential negative in the I'm a good person thing? Right, right. View Christianity's message as how to be a good person. And in a sense, the first step of the gospel is going, you know what, I'm actually not a good person. I've had some pretty glaring examples when I'm not, and I need someone who's an even better person. And in a way, it's a plus, as some of us have noted, but it's also a potential challenge, because if I'm already a pretty good person, I'm as good as him and I'm just as good as her, well then, I don't need a saviour. Religion is all about just kind of social niceness, and I'm okay at that. So it's a problem in a sense too. So your purpose in life is to make good use of what you've been given, to give and learn to others. I'm still searching, some people say, but my life has meaning. My purpose is yet to arrive. It can't be constructed by me. What are the beliefs? And we ask them, how do you deal with crisis? When you go through a storm, how do you deal with that? Well, you say, I'm a good person. We're back to that again. I'm a good person. I've had all these bad things happen, but I'm a good person. What goes around will come around. I'm grateful for all I've been given, and these negative things will test me. Maybe I'm being watched over by my grandma who's died, or maybe by God or something, maybe. But that was just a little afterthought. Most of it was, I'm a good person. What fills the spiritual void? A sense of self-assurance and self-awareness, a focus on the family, focus on achievement, creativity, busyness, shopping. No kidding, that was on a lot of people's lists. How do you handle the hard times? Shop. Retail therapy. Having fun. Oh, and being a good person, again. And other beliefs like karma. So they're not out there going, could someone please enlighten me with spiritual truth? They're just like, oh, that's a bargain, you know.
What questions did you
There wasn't a formal question sheet. Just we had interviewers who were pretty intuitive in pulling out. They had a guide sheet, but they'd just kind of fish.
Were the interviewers themselves Christian?
No, they weren't. And I think they'd been to Christian schools and thought they knew a bit about it, but they weren't. Yeah. I've listened to the tapes and in that way supervised the whole interview and kind of tried to get across it in that way. Is there a mind or a spirit behind the universe? Their attitudes were marked more by curiosity or mild indifference than wonder. They weren't going, wow, why is this flower as it is? They were just going, oh, well, yeah, maybe. Curiosity, the Big Bang or God, could be both. I don't know. I'm not going to get hung up on creation questions. What's outside the outside of the universe? No idea. And indifference, we can't know. God's beyond us. Too big to comprehend. I don't go there. Connection to nature. Yeah, they connect to nature, but not the universe. God or science. Depends what you've decided to believe. Maybe both. Don't really care. What inclines you to believe or not? We need to move on quickly. God has answered my prayers. Some people say when good things happen, I thank God. Belief is a power that protects. Holy days, family belief. Disbelief, the things they hate, religious extremity, war, hard times that test faith. When bad things keep happening to me, despite the fact that, here we go again, I am a good person. And the hypocrisy of religious people, who are apparently not good persons sometimes. Plus, religion doesn't fit with my life focus. In summary, it's hard to tell from 11 opening interviews whether this picture is true for the whole of Australia, let alone where you live. Extreme reaction to being judged or being sold a religion, though, is one thing we do find. People want personalized beliefs and a willingness to accept dissonance and contradiction. I actually think that's really useful. If you try to sell somebody an institutional religion, forget it. It's too hard. We've got to, and I work for an organized religion, or usually organized, but I think what we can promote is the idea of a personal quest and personal growth in faith and personal curiosity. And I think that is the way to do it without ringing alarm bells for people. And they also say we want to see goodness expressed in behavior. Talk is cheap. For an apologist trying to make a film series, I guess I can show good behavior and depict Christians in charitable kind of ways. It's one way. But ultimately, it might be that it depends on the quality of the person they receive the film from. In other words, the most powerful way my film series could get out there is if people who are loved and respected in their community say, what do you think about this? And so in a way, we're relying on the church there as an apologetic. We're relying on Christians to do the heavy lifting for us on that one. Any questions or comments on that before we roll on? That's a great question. And just repeating for the tape, is there an assumption in what I've been saying so far that if we can just present God well enough in their terms, they'll all come to faith? It's a great question. I hope the answer is no, because I'm not assuming that everyone will come to faith. You know, you read the Acts 17 thing and there's a use of the word some. Some believed, and some mocked, and some said, oh, we'll hear you later, you know, procrastination. So you do get that mixed response, and that's all I'd ever expect. I guess I'm just trying to do the best job possible, humanly speaking, trusting, of course, that God will do what he's decided to do and will save, you know, those bring to himself those he wants. I mean, I feel a bit like Paul again, you know, where he says, I became all things to all men so that by all means I could save some, you know. And there is always that frustration, isn't there? Two hands up there. Yeah, go for it. This survey cost about $15,000. I guess, first of all, you may draw some broad principles for something like this for your context. Two, if you know somebody who's in market research in your church, it may well be something that they would do as a volunteer thing, using their expertise, and help others to do it in a professional kind of a way, or even something that they would guide a bunch of amateurs through trying. I just think it's an approach to people of going, okay, where are you coming from? How can I best understand you? And it's probably valuable at that level. If you can do it formally, fantastic. It may help quite a bit. I was dealing with a fairly big budget in a filmmaking, and I felt irresponsible spending that much on production before I'd done some research, because no advertising company would ever do that. You know, there's got to be research behind everything you do, and yes, it's open to manipulation. So that was actually a social research. So they call themselves a social research company that did that first report. The next people are market researchers. I'm not sure what the difference is as far as this goes. We did a survey this time of more people across a spread of beliefs, but the biggest one was, I have spiritual beliefs, but I don't identify with any main religion. That was the most common. They were all in the middle. On one side, I consider myself a Christian. On the other side, I'm passionately opposed to Christianity. Most of our respondents were in that middle. I love this. This was the biggest aha for me. What we're asking people is, what are the things, in terms of thoughts and feelings and your inner, you know, processing, what drives you towards faith and what drives you away? The first thing you can't read there is intuitions, feelings, and sense. Intuitions, feelings, and sense. And that drove people towards God. Intuitions and feelings drove people towards God, the idea of a personal God. Personal experiences, they said, drove them towards God. Their perceptions and observations, I'm using their words that they gave us, were either way. But when it came to lines of argument, logic, philosophy, and knowledge, that drove them away from God. Does that make sense? Now, if I was a pietist, I guess I'd say, well, of course. Right? But I'm not. You're welcome to argue with me, but from my own perspective, I want to do something about that. And respect it, it won't work in every case. But for people, I want to say, hang on a minute. In Christ are hid all treasures of wisdom and knowledge. You know, I want to say with John, in the beginning was the Logos that you think you've known about all this time. I know who it is. I want to say with Paul, this unknown God that you're celebrating, I can tell you who it is. I know him. And so that really bugs me. To summarize that, I'd say people are saying emotionally they lean towards belief. Intuitively, to put it very simply, in heart matters, they lean towards belief, but their head gets in the way. And if that's true, then in some ways apologetics is the task of giving people intellectual permission to believe. That makes sense? Because in most churches in my country, they haven't heard basic apologetical arguments. And for so many people, when they do, from some of the churches in our city who do good campus ministry and use apologetics, logical, rational, faith kind of stuff, these people come to faith in droves. There are big Anglican churches in Sydney that do awesome on-campus ministry. And just, it's not rocket science, they just go through and present the logical case for Christ. And young professionals, young uni students just go, oh, that makes sense. And they just, those churches are packed. So in a sense, yeah, you could read this research either way. You could go, so let's build on what's already working. And I'd defend that. With a lot of people, that'll work. But particularly, going back to the tribes, particularly with your Balmain tribe, logic is everything. And for those guys, if it's not logical, you're just never going to get them. You're just never going to have them in your church. We asked them then, well, what holds the most weighting? And they said, 46% of people said, well, I'm rational. I decide with my brain. 23 said, oh, yeah, I go with my feelings. 31 said, both, equal. Now, there's a few problems with that slide already. Number one, how do you know what really drives you to things? I wouldn't claim to know. Of course, I'm rational. Oh, ho, ho. You know. But when we talk about car purchases, most people don't buy... I won't speak for you. Most people don't buy the car it's most rational for them to have. They want the red one, you know, that was advertised with the hot girls in it and the... Those are factors in people's thinking, right? And they may not know it. So in a sense, that slide might... I don't know how useful it is. But I think that one, if only you could read it, is quite insightful. If people are saying heart says yes to the idea of God, head says no, what do we do about that? Well, right, we build on... No question, we build on the heart thing. We talk about the implications of belief and the futility of life without God and all those things. But we also, I think, try to counter the logical attacks on Christian faith. So what are they? The arguments against God's existence? I was surprised by this. The biggest one that popped up, problem of hell. How could a loving God let people suffer unending pain for eternity in hell? Right? We've got an apologetical challenge right there to work out what we're going to say to that one. I don't have time this afternoon. Number two, the problem of the supernatural. As a rational, scientific, modern person, I can't believe in a God who deals in angels and demons, resurrections, and walking on water, and miracles. And maybe they've heard a lot of superstitious fairy stories in their traditional Christian backgrounds. That, again, I think is where a rational approach to the supernatural, where you start with the ordinary and the arguments for God in science, and then gently build towards supernatural claims. But take it really steady. Number three was the problem of pain. I expected that to be number one. We suffer. This suggests there cannot be a God who is kind, wise, and strong enough to stop it happening. We've done a whole film about that very issue. I think the way you respond to that is to say, well, here's this thing called the Christian free will defense, and here's various other approaches to the problem of pain. That's a massive topic, as you well know. But I'm just flagging that it's an argument against for many people. What are the arguments for God's existence? The ones they liked the most, I was surprised, was the argument from consciousness. The human mind is more than the physical brain and cannot be explained as a product of a universe that only has matter and no mind elsewhere in it or behind it. A better explanation would be a larger mind giving us consciousness. I couldn't believe how people kind of went, yeah, and they just loved that one. So we've made a film about it. We've gone to Tokyo and interviewed top artificial intelligence specialists who tell us a robot will never think in the way that a human being does. Okay, so what's consciousness then? And we try to grope after that with the help of Dr. John Luce, one of the presenters here at ELF. And we talk to atheists. Daniel Dennett, who's a philosopher of mind, one of the leading atheists, he gives the other view. Yes, your mind is just made of physical stuff, cells just doing what cells do. And it just falls completely flat. So we've responded on that point. Cosmological argument. The universe could not have kickstarted itself, so there must be something outside of it. We made a film on that, which I screened last night. Some of you may have seen that one. It's screening again on Tuesday night, I think it is, in the late night session, so feel free to come. Oh, commercial. Slip that in so well you didn't even notice. Number three, design. The existence, and this was really fraught, the existence of superb engineering in nature, for example, a bird's flight technology, suggests an engineer. The language like complexity and spelling of DNA, 3.5 billion chemical letters compared to only 130,000 for a Shakespeare play, suggests an author. And people kind of went, yeah. And you could, it was interesting, you heard people kind of go in the interview, yes, yes. Oh, but hang on. I did science class and they told me it all happened by random processes in evolution. So it was your classic heart going, yeah, brain going, oh, but wait. And so I'm going to argue that there's a place for kind of trying to knock down that stronghold, in a sense, logically. If it's a logical problem, sort it out logically. Fine-tuning was another one. The fact that so many factors went right for planet Earth to support life, plus that so many physics variables are at just the right settings for the universe to exist, suggests a God. Yes, please, they said. They loved the moral argument as well, not surprisingly. There are moral absolutes. For example, it's never morally right to rape or cause unnecessary pain to a child or an animal. We cannot get moral absolutes from nature, which is about survival of the fittest and selfish genes, not altruism or loving neighbour. We can get some morals from society, but these change with times and places. For example, 1930s Germany. So, historically, the only place humans have found moral absolutes is in the idea of a God who holds me accountable for how I treat my neighbour and cares about everyone. So the existence of morality suggests that God exists. They love that one. They love that one. We could talk more about their views of people who believe in God. The size of the word determines how common that response was. People who believe in God are good and religious and spiritual. They might be ordinary and overbearing and ignorant, have blind faith and misguided. They might be intelligent. You can see some mixed answers there. Christians who regularly attend church, good, dedicated, but conservative, scared, fake. There's a few negatives there as well. Lame. Followers of Jesus, good and Christian, turn the other cheek, but they're judgmental and fanatical and narrow-minded, and they're sheep. Born-again Christians, annoying! Whoa, easy, that's my tribe, you know. I think that tag kind of had scary implications for people. Evangelical Christians, have a look at it. Deluded, enthusiastic, obsessive, excluding. Tele-evangelists, oh my word, that kind of hurts, right? That's my people you're talking about there. Non-Christians, scientific, reasonable, respectable, logical, learned, mathematical, and evolutionary. But also, check this out. Arrogant, lost, weak, scared, discontent, bitter, proud, broken, stubborn, detached, defensive, ignorant, narrow-minded, belligerent. Oh my word, I didn't make that up. Anyway, so look, much more we could say. I've appreciated your comments. We're just about out of time. In summary, I guess what I've tried to achieve is to get us thinking like marketeers a bit, just to kickstart a process of curiosity into marketing and marketing research and social research, whatever the difference might be, and to try to I guess get a curiosity in the church about these approaches. I think they're useful for evangelism. We've barely begun to look at some of them, but hopefully broad principles there. Have you learned major new things? Probably not, but I hope I've maybe given you a language to put your existing assumptions and views into words. I think there's quite a bit of profit in this kind of thing for Christian faith, and particularly for evangelism. Final comments or questions? So back to STP, we chose particularly one segment. We chose the Balmain segment because for a number of reasons, apologetics seems built for those guys. Their thoughtful approach to things, great. So we hope there'll be spillover into other tribes, but that was how we segmented. We aimed for those guys. They're a global class. How do we then target them? We thought, well, they love documentary. So we chose... And targeting them, we also tried to understand all their presuppositions, did a bunch of market research into them, and then positioning, we'll try to get it onto those channels that they watch, yeah, in our country. And also on the internet, hoping they'll recommend it to their friends globally. Yeah. Cool. Thanks a lot for your company. Different denominations seem to do better in different classes. So, for example, Hillsong reaches your lower middle class and upper working class person, because that's where the church is and that's kind of who they've targeted, I think. They have people across the board, but that's where they tend to focus. The Anglicans in Sydney tend to reach the upper class and the upper middle class. That's just traditionally how they've rolled. Baptists, for example, tend to, I think, spread across the board. They're one of the more active and successful churches. And you could go through. Salvation Army tends to appeal many times to the poorer welfare person. Different denominations seem to have different strengths in a way. But probably the toughest ones to reach are what we've called the Newtown tribe. They're the do-it-yourself people, and they just don't like organized religion. And also Balmain, they're very tough to reach. I don't know why traditionally, but they just have been. So hence a special effort for them. Yeah. Thanks for your company, guys. Blessings to you.